Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to have you all here, and I'm pleased that we've got a good turnout to hear tonight's speaker, Michael Engwin. As the flyer very effectively put it, Australian uranium exports, atoms for peace or too hot to handle. The issue of nuclear proliferation, the issues of nuclear energy are obviously very hot issues. They're issues that engage the community very directly. They have enormous domestic effects. They have enormous international effects. And I think a lot of people get very, very confused. I mean, there's a lot of science involved. There's a lot of judgments involved. There's a lot of emotion involved, and what we really need is somebody like Michael Engwin to come along and help us through the jungle of the problems. Think of what's happened in the last couple of years. We've had Fukushima, which must have set back the nuclear industry internationally very significantly. We've seen what Angela Merkel did in Germany, immediately putting a kibosh on the further development of the German nuclear industry. We've got Iran getting closer to capacity and nuclear issues. Do they have nuclear weapons or not? That's an enormously big question, enormously important question, one which will be addressed here at the Institute on the 22nd of March when we have a talk by Professor Otto Lengi from one of, I think, Georgetown University, who will talk about Iran's nuclear industry. Our Australia's decision to sell uranium to India has been something that has caused a lot of angst in the Australian community, partly because India, of course, is not a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, partly because people are concerned that Australian uranium might be used to fuel the problems between nuclear problems between India and Pakistan. So, as I say, there are lots and lots of issues to be discussed. And Michael Engwin, as Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Uranium Association, is the man who's come here tonight to try and help us work our way through it all. Michael's been the CEO of the association since 2006. Previously, he worked as a consultant in the Victorian Department of Premier and Cabinet. He's had experience working with Rio. He was Assistant Director of the Business Council of Australia. I'm sure that what Michael has to say will be extremely interesting. I'm sure that not everybody's going to agree with what Michael says, but then he's used to that. And I'm sure there are a lot of people here who do agree with what he has to say. So over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Les, and thank you very much to the Institute for inviting me to speak with you this evening. I think the international affairs focus on the nuclear industry and on uranium mining in Australia adds a dimension to the discussion and to the debate, a richer dimension which in the toing and froing which I often have to go through on a daily basis is refreshing and encouraging. So many thank yous for your invitation this evening. These are the key points I'm going to make tonight. Uranium politics in Australia has changed dramatically and for the better in the last 5 years. The forecast of demand for nuclear power made in 2011 are lower than those made in 2010. Notwithstanding that, the fundamentals driving the demand for nuclear power and for Australia's uranium remain what they were on the 10th of March 2011. And Australian development is proceeding in that light on the basis of merit under assessment and approval under Australia's environmental laws. And whilst development is proceeding, we in the uranium industry have a competitiveness issue. We're punching below our weight, and I want to talk a bit about that. I've been asked to talk about the Energy White Paper about India and about nuclear power for Australia, and I will do that. The Energy White Paper is very supportive of the development of the Australian uranium industry, includes within it what I think is the most progressive political development on nuclear power since last century, but is remarkably inconsistent on the question of nuclear power. On India, I'm going to tell you that the government's the best judge, and on nuclear power for Australia, I think there's still a question mark about that, notwithstanding the support which it now has in the Energy White Paper. Australia's uranium politics has changed dramatically and favourably in the last six years. In 2006, there were three mines. The Australian Labor Party had a negative policy on uranium mining. With the exception of South Australia and to some extent the Northern Territory, the states were negative. There was no industry voice, or much of an industry voice, for uranium mining. NGOs were dominant in the debate. Opinion was split about uranium and the nuclear industry, and on uranium it was split 40-40-20, that is 40% in favour, 40% against, and 20% undecided, and it was clear there was no nuclear agenda for Australia. In the 6 years, or the five or so years since then, we've got an additional mine, and there's approval for a fifth mine, and in the next couple of years there will be new mines in Western Australia and possibly in other places as well. The ALP at the national level is very positive about the uranium industry, and there's bipartisanship on uranium mining at the national level. There's the states are much more positive. The West Australian government now supports uranium mining. The New South Wales government has signalled that it is prepared to allow uranium exploration, at least in that state, and things might change even more positively depending upon the election result in Queensland. I believe now that the industry has a clear and unified voice, and much of that is due to the efforts of the CEOs of Australia's uranium companies. NGOs have become marginalised in this debate, but maybe marginalised is a bit stronger term, but I think they've largely failed to detect the change in the way the wind is blowing, and a policy of outright opposition to uranium mining doesn't get you much of a say when the issues that politicians are dealing with are, does this proposal meet the requirements of environmental law? Opinion is changing. My own view is that whereas it was 40-40-20 5 years ago, it's now 40-20-40. There has, I believe, been a decline in the opposition to nuclear power and a rise in those who are uncertain or making up their minds. I'm not saying that the positive vote has gone up, but I do think the negative has gone down, and those who are making up their mind now are a larger proportion of the population. But there's an interesting point about whether it actually matters to most people, and I want to talk about that as well. And I think now nuclear power is possible, at least in the medium term in Australia. I want to talk about the drivers and facilitators of change over the last 5 years, and let me first talk about the political leadership, which has come from a wide variety of sources in Australia. Ian McFarlane in the federal opposition, Martin Ferguson certainly, Kevin Rudd, who is responsible for the change in policy in the ALP, Mike Rand's leadership and possibly Jay Weatherill's leadership in South Australia, Colin Barnett's leadership in Western Australia and the change of policy there. Julia Gillard, who in an appearance on Q&A a week after Fukushima felt she was able to say that her government continued to support the uranium industry in Australia, and it was the Prime Minister who sponsored the change in the ALP's attitude to exports to India. And most recently, Barry O'Farrell, who has signalled that one of your sister organisations, the Lowy Institute, that his government is prepared to see uranium exploration location, at least in New South Wales. I also want to talk about the leadership by the CEOs of Australia's uranium businesses, and I think that they realised how challenging the task of reform has to be, and they approached it with the requirements of reform at the forefront of their minds at all times. And those requirements included best practice operationally for them, and as a result of their efforts, the Australian Uranium Association now has a code of practice which applies to members of the association wherever they operate in the world, not only in Australia but Africa and in other places as well. Those other requirements included strong local links, including with Indigenous communities. Importantly, moderation in the tone that they adopt in their public stances, developing working relationships with their stakeholders more broadly, bringing a matter of factness to their businesses and to the advocacy for their businesses, and not defensiveness, and I think openness and transparency. With few exceptions, the Australia's uranium companies have operated by those standards, and I have to tell you, as the CEO of their association, that's made my work much easier. One of the key drivers of change has been the continuing demand for nuclear power globally, and notwithstanding some decline in demand, which I'll show you some slides on in a moment, the fundamental drivers still remain the same. Countries want nuclear energy because it allows them to diversify their energy portfolios, and that's important for their energy security, and especially in Asia. Economic growth is heavily dependent upon electricity, growth in supply of electricity, and countries again wish to diversify their energy portfolios for that reason. And they're responding, remember, to large populations which know what an iPad is, and they want one. They want to have the wealth and the opportunities that we have here in Australia. And so countries like China and India are responding to that with economic liberalisation and other achievements and initiatives, which include growing the nuclear power industries. And of course, climate change is one of the drivers of the demand for clean sources of energy. And nuclear power is one of the cleanest sources of energy across the life cycle. It emits no greenhouse gas emissions in generating electricity, and across the life cycle, that is, you take into account from mining to the management of waste disposal, the emissions from the nuclear industry on an output basis are about the same as that for wind, and something you may find surprising, considerably less than solar. So all of which are low, by the way, so I'm not disparaging solar in saying that. I'm just saying that nuclear's life cycle record is considerably better. So climate change is one of the drivers of demand for nuclear energy. One of the others, I think, is in a sense geopolitical, although I feel a bit on shaky ground there because I'm an economist and I'm not an expert in international relations, but at least some of Australia's attitude has been driven, I think, by the desire to have relationships with both China and India, during the last 5 years Australia signed a bilateral treaty with China allowing Australia's uranium to be exported there, and as you know, the Prime Minister has signalled a change in the Labor Party's policy, and at some time over the next 2 or 3 years I expect that that will also give rise to a bilateral treaty enabling Australia to export uranium. One of the other drivers or facilitators of change is in fact that uranium is not a salient issue for most Australians, and people tend to think that there's a large groundswell of active opposition to uranium mining or to nuclear power in Australia, but I don't think the evidence supports that. Just a couple of things. In announcing the opposition leader in Western Australia, when he came to office there a couple of weeks ago, announced changes in two policies. One was to to the ALP's policy on shopping hours on Sundays in Perth, and the other was on uranium mining. Both the Australian and the Western Australian support reported as its main story the lifting of of the ALP's, well, the changing the ALP's position on Sunday trading in Perth. Uranium was a secondary story, and I think that that reflects, I think, the fact that both the Australian and the West Australian know their readers, and I think they actually got it right. But to be a bit more serious about that, our own polling tells us that about 1% of Australians, for about 1% of Australians, uranium and nuclear issues are at the top of their issues list. Most Australians, or the majority, the main issue which Australians will tell you about if you ask them what concerns them, and they'll say war and poverty. But nuclear power and uranium issues is well and truly at the bottom of their list. I wouldn't blame you if you're a bit sceptical if I quote my own research, so I'll quote somebody else's. Professor Danny Stelic, who did some work when she was at the at Charles Darwin University for the Australian Academy of Science and Technology, found that uranium and nuclear issues were only salient for a small proportion of Australians. And I have to tell you that, looking across my audience tonight, you're the demographic for which uranium and nuclear issues are salient. But for most of the, Australians will give you a view if you ask them, it doesn't preoccupy their family dinner conversations, although I might say it does preoccupy mine sometimes. If I can just move on to the issue of the demand for nuclear power, I want to show you three or four slides on that. This first one is from the International Atomic Energy Agency, which shows its estimates, its 2011 estimates. And to give all this some context, I think I'd start with the point, to make the point that the demand for electricity will increase by around 80% by 2035, according to the International Energy Agency. So while there'll be competition for market share between and within energy fuel supply sectors, it will be within an expanding market. What the International Atomic Energy Agency's estimates made in 2011 tell us are, first of all, and there are low and high estimates there, which you can see in the chart, and both of those tell you that there is continued growth in demand for nuclear power in both the high and the low scenarios. But they also tell you, and this is not surprising at all, that the forecasts made in 2011 are lower than those made by the agency in 2010 by about 5 or 10%, and I think you'd be right if you said that's probably the Fukushima effect. There are other forecasts as well. I wanted to look at the World Nuclear Association's forecasts, and they show a similar picture overall, although the figures differ. The World Nuclear Association compiles its data on a bottom-up basis from information provided to it by its members. It doesn't just accept all those estimates, which are, in a sense, are current planning scenarios. What it does is apply some assumptions about what might happen and what might not. So, in effect, they discount the raw results they get. And that's what you see here. The WNA's 2011 forecast compared to its 2009 forecast shows that for the reference scenario and the high scenario, the projections for nuclear demand or the growth in nuclear generating capacity are about the same, with the lower scenario showing a steeper falling off in growth than it did when the estimates were made in 2009. The WNA, in that little chart on the side, that bar graph on the side, also forecasts some compositional change some change in the composition of growth since 2009, with slightly lower growth forecasts in most of the world, with the exception of China, where the WNA sees significantly higher growth. These figures were published in September last year. And finally, on on reactor capacity, and again by region, these are figures by the US Energy Information Administration, comparing the nuclear capacity in 2008 with the forecast capacity in 2035, this more or less confirms a broad picture painted by both the International Atomic Energy Agency and by the World Nuclear Association, namely there will be continued growth in the nuclear industry, growth all round, but with significant Chinese, more significant Chinese and Indian growth. The nuclear outlook, I think, is that despite Fukushima, the prospects for new worldwide reactor construction continue to be strong. But I suspect we will have to wait a year or two to get some greater clarity about that that growth pathway for the nuclear industry. I think there are still a few uncertainties out there. The demand for nuclear power and the growth of nuclear operating capacity is reflected in the world's uranium requirements. Again, I want to start with the World Nuclear Association, and this shows the expected growth in the nuclear industry is reflected in the growth in the demand for uranium, or the requirements that the nuclear reactors will have for uranium. And here we see the WNA forecast for the world's uranium requirements matches forecast for nuclear demand. A slightly low scenario in 2011. That's not a lower growth scenario compared to its 2009 forecast, with this reference scenario and its high scenario about the same or higher. The WNA also forecasts uranium production. It's a bit busy, this overhead, so I won't ask you to dwell on all of it, but again there's one point here. I think that the WNA's forecast for uranium production show a similar picture as its forecast for nuclear demand and for uranium, for nuclear and uranium demand, namely that the high and reference scenarios remain about the same, the lower scenario falling off a bit. The conclusions the WNA draws are, first of all, that in the reference scenario, the world's demand for uranium will be about 107,000 tonnes in 2030, and that's 70% more than it was in 2010. In the upper scenario, the demand is about 137,000 tonnes. Uranium production that means that uranium production in the reference scenario must rise by at least two-thirds to meet that demand. And in the upper demand scenario, world uranium production has to double to meet the high scenario demand. And they conclude that the need for new primary production facilities will be substantial in the longer term, along with the secondary suppliers. Now, you probably know that at the moment, a good proportion of the world's uranium comes from secondary suppliers, and one of the major secondary suppliers is that Russia dismantles its nuclear weapons, downblends the uranium and sells it to the United States to help them run their nuclear industry, their civil nuclear industry. So secondary suppliers will continue to play a role, although there are some uncertainties about whether the Russians and the Americans will have a similar agreement after 2013. Just to complement those macro forecasts, I wanted to show you this slide, which I find an extremely interesting one, because it's a supply side view at the micro level, informed by a real business perspective rather than a macro measure like the International Atomic Energy Agency or the WNA. And this is one prepared by John Borshoff, who's the chief executive of Paladin Energy. And John's kind of a real businessman. He's an astute guy, and he's been around the uranium industry longer than most. So I like John, and I think he has some interesting views. So I've used this. What it shows, what John is saying, is that demand and supply can be reconciled around price. Well, no news in that. Anybody who has any knowledge of economics will realise that demand and supply will be reconciled around price. But what he goes on to argue is that the current price won't bring forth the supply indicated by the growth of nuclear power. And he says that there will be a supply deficit quite soon. And I think that even at the macro level, level, there are people who are suggesting there might be a supply deficit quite soon. Not quite as soon as John's, maybe not as quite as large as John's, but I think there's a growing realisation that there may well be a deficit in the supply of uranium at the current price, at least. Well, we'll see. But the main point I wanted to make is that taken together, the long-term macro forecasts and the Paladin forecast from a supplier's point of view point to a pretty optimistic outlook for uranium producers and for the nuclear industry. But that doesn't mean it's all plain sailing for the Australian uranium industry. This chart shows, I think, pretty clearly the competitive challenge that we face here in Australia, the international competitive challenge that we face. We're punching well below our weight in a comparison of our production to resources with other countries. What we've done here is to produce a ratio of a country's share of world resources to their share of the world market, and we've compared those two ratios. So what this shows is that all our competitors, with the exception of Russia, are producing more than their uranium endowment entitles them to do, with Kazakhstan punching spectacularly above its weight, and even Canada, which has faced a range of production issues, easily outstripping Australia. In the longer term, Olympic Dam, which is the largest uranium mine in the world, or will be the largest uranium mine in the world, we'll pull these figures back a bit, but it won't be. We'll pull these figures back a lot, but that won't be during this decade. And there are some particular reasons why the Australian figures are quite low. They did peak at 10,000 tonnes a year. One is the fact that Ranger has been severely affected by extreme weather in the last two dry wet seasons, and didn't operate for much of those. And secondly, there was an incident which closed one of the underground shafts at Olympic Dam. So there are some one-offs in that figure, but I think the point still remains that we're punching below our weight, and for much of the rest of this decade, Australia's competitive performance internationally will depend upon what happens in non-Olympic Dam development in South Australia, Western Australia, and in the Northern Territory, and to some extent in Queensland. So just to return to the global outlook and a kind of summary here, and it's just to bring this all together, Fukushima has produced uncertainty and has certainly produced a fall in the spot price, and that certainly hurts the industry in the short term. There's no doubt about that, and companies say that. The growth in future demand is lower than in the past, according to the forecast made in 2011. Again, the Fukushima effect. Notwithstanding that, there is little disagreement that the fundamental drivers of nuclear power will remain in place, and that nuclear power will continue to grow under the influence of those drivers. But what the precise growth pathway is, I think, is uncertain. It's not clear. There are some certainties. I think one is that I believe the Germans, when they say they're shutting down their nuclear industry, and an interesting observation on that is that if you think that they might somehow change their mind quite soon, is that if they shut down their reactors for 5 years, then they won't be able to start them again. So I believe the Germans. I think they are going to shut down their nuclear industry. On the other hand, the other certainties that are that India and China are going to grow theirs quite rapidly. But there's still some way to go before the outlook clears. From an Australian point of view, the important point, I think, is that we need to improve our competitiveness and our market share. I think the key prescription here for Australia is to have assessment and approval of uranium mines on merit under environmental law, rather than based upon arbitrary views, mainly based in the 1980s, which is the date from which, for example, the prohibitive legislation here in Victoria and New South Wales dates. Just to move in a bit more detail to the Australian uranium industry, I think this is a classic industry development picture here. We have national bipartisanship on uranium policy, and that's now settled. There's no chance, in my view, that either of the main political parties, not even the ALP in an alliance with the Greens, is going to change its mind on uranium development. There are three operating mines, and a fourth just started to produce uranium late last year. That's the Honeymoon mine on the border of South Australia and New South Wales. The fifth mine at Four Mile, also in South Australia, has been approved by former Environment Minister Garrett, and subject to some joint venture disputes between the joint venture partners, that mine is ready to go. There has been some recent good news, one of which is the agreement between the South Australian Government and BHP Billiton on the Olympic Dam expansion, and the environmental approval of that dam, that mine has been announced. And that clears away most of the barriers which stand in the way of the BHP board taking a decision on the expansion sometime this year. The other good news for our industry has been the Prime Minister's decision to seek and succeed in seeking a change in ALP's policy on exports to India. Now, I want to talk about India, but the point I want to make is that the Prime Minister and the Australian Labor Party felt sufficiently confident about our industry in order to be able to change its view on India. And the other good news has been the decision by Barry O'Farrell in New South Wales to permit at least exploration for uranium in that state. There's still some dark clouds lining that silver. These are uranium politics issues. Four of the top 10 non-Olympic dam developments are still quarantined. The Angela Pamela development south of Alice Springs in the Northern Territory, Kungara, which I think is now part of the national park. I think that's a development which is not going to take place. Jabiluka, which is the mine close to Ranger, and Mount Gee in the Flinders Ranges in South Australia. So they're the four of the top ten non Olympic Dam developments, and they've been quarantined. The second issue we have to deal with is that our industry faces quite high approval hurdles, and we believe not always based upon merit, but attributable to uranium politics. And the third barrier we face is overcoming the political barriers on the East Coast in Queensland, in Victoria, and in New South Wales. In contrast, West Australia, development is proceeding on merit, and Toro's Wiluna project is late in its environmental approval process. If it continues on the path that it's on, it's very likely to get approval, and very likely the construction of that mine will begin either late this year or early next year. There are three other projects in Western Australia: Cameco's Kintyre project, BHP's Yeelirrie project, and Mega's project at Lake Maitland. They are at varying stages of development, and there are a number of others. So development's proceeding in Western Australia. And the last point I want to make is about exploration, and I think that's in a sense the untold story of the Australian uranium industry. In 2003-2004, Australia's uranium companies invested $10 million in uranium exploration. By 2010-2011, that had risen to $213 million, up from $169 million in 2009-2010, but less than the peak of $230 million in 2008-2009. So the message here, I think, is that the Australian uranium industry is developing steadily, and I expect that development to continue and to give rise to new mines, and maybe far somewhere between 5 to 10 new mines by the end of this decade. Can I turn to India? And I begin by saying that that the announcement by the Prime Minister in the year of Fukushima, when you might have thought an ALP government would be shy of more uranium reform, that she wanted to change the party's platform to allow a non-NPT country to receive Australia's uranium, tells you just how much uranium politics has changed in Australia in the last 5 years. The uranium industry didn't lobby for that change. We point out when asked what the economic case for exports is. 2,500 tonnes a year we estimate is probably what the Indians might want from us or get from us in the future, worth about $300 million in today's money. The case is that exports are valuable for the companies who might access the Indian market, and exporting is consistent with Australia's market-based economic policy and with the economic aim of expanding exports, and that there is no case for singling out uranium per se as an Australian commodity that not should be explored for, found, developed, mined and exported. What made India different is that it is not an NPT signatory, and we recognise that there are larger issues than those which we can credibly claim expertise on that needed to be examined. And we believe the government of the day, whatever its colour, is in the best position to make that decision, to weigh all the factors, including the economic case, but we recognise that the economic case is only one of the factors under consideration. And the factors we saw being brought to bear on the government's decision were the world's changing global approach to India, especially the approach of the United States, which now has a close and developing nuclear relationship with India, but not only India, also Russia and Canada as well. The second thing we observed was considerable pressure from India publicly on the Australian government to change its approach to India, to exports to India. And finally, I think there were also Australian reasons for a uranium relationship with India, and I hesitate to tread on territory where you'll likely be much more expert than I am, but India is a very large potential market for Australia's goods, and a good relationship with India across the board seems to me to have been part of the factors in the mix here. Now, I think you can speculate about the relationship between Australia and India, or United States and India, by reference to China. But I've got to tell you that I feel very uncertain in that field. But and you may feel more comfortable with that than I am. I think the key issue is will exports to a non-NPT signatory country undermine the non-proliferation treaty? The Australian government says no. It will apply NPT-like standards to India. It will apply the standards in the bilateral treaties which Australia has with over 40 countries, about a dozen of which we export to. I'd expect that to be a matter for a pretty significant negotiation over 2 or 3 years. Am I going? Where's that got time?
A few more minutes.
Nuclear power for Australia. I don't believe Fukushima is a barrier to that. Public opinion has changed little in the light of Fukushima. AusPol conducted a poll on the question of Australian attitudes to nuclear power in December 2010, not one we commissioned them to do, I might say, which showed that 36% of Australians supported a nuclear industry. Low, but about a third. We did commission them, however, to ask the same question in April 2011, because we wanted to know how Fukushima might have affected that. And what they told us was that 33% of Australians supported a nuclear industry. Now, there's a fall-off in support, but I don't think a significant fall-off of support. So I don't think Fukushima is a barrier to public opinion on nuclear power in Australia. And our view is there's no reason in principle why Australia should not use nuclear energy, which is a reliable source of continuous supply for large communities. Whether it does, whether Australia does adopt nuclear energy will depend upon a number of issues, including the economics of nuclear energy and the economics and technology of the competing electricity sources, and whether there is sufficient political support to lead the community to a source of electricity that the country might actually need. Now, there's a paradox in this, and so I think there's a great paradox in this, is that in the Energy White Paper, the federal government points to a lack of nuclear social consensus to nuclear power, yet it's the government itself that is at least partly responsible for the lack of consensus, because it says it doesn't support nuclear power. Nuclear power, if it is to occur in Australia as a result of the market it operating, it has to be able to compete. But the government's policy is the main reason why nuclear power gets no opportunity to compete in response to market conditions. Having said that, the White Paper is still, I think, the most progressive position on nuclear power, at least politically speaking, this century. It makes the point that a future government might wish to renew nuclear power if renewables are not delivering by 2020. Interestingly, the Federal Treasury, in its thousands of pages of modelling for the carbon tax, said that renewables should produce 20% of Australia's electricity by 2020. Now, that seems to me to be the benchmark now. On the one hand, the government saying a future government might consider nuclear power if renewables don't deliver, and the Federal Treasury says it ought to be 20% by 2020. So I think that seems to me to be the benchmark. At the same time, the White Paper is full of frustrating inconsistencies. It speaks of energy inclusiveness via a portfolio of energy sources, but excludes nuclear power. It calls for a dialogue based upon scientific and economic analysis for everything but nuclear power. And it eschews further distorting non-market energies in energy policy while refusing the market to operate for nuclear power. Given the long lead times, it makes sense to begin the task of nuclear regulatory reform and nuclear regulatory infrastructure building now, so that the country can act quickly at the end of the decade if it had to. And I might say, as a concluding point, the Grattan Institute made this point in the release of its research report on energy choices this week, and made the point that if you start to build Australia's nuclear regulatory infrastructure now, then it'll take 5 years off the lead time if we were to embark on nuclear energy by the end of this decade. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. We've got about 25 minutes for questions. I might just say, prior to getting to the questions, I hope we'll be able to have your presentation on our website. For those of you who are sitting with your back, like me, who are sitting with your back to the presentation, you tend to miss out on a bit. But there's been a lot. Thank you, Zara. There was a lot of information given to us this evening, and some of it, I'm sure, given that you're the 1% of the demographic which challenges the notion of nuclear energy, I'm sure we should have quite an interesting session. In asking questions, can you please give your name and any association with which you are affiliated? Gentleman in the yellow striped tie.
My name is Jeff McLaughlin.
Could you stand up and shout?
My name is Jeff McLaughlin. I have no affiliation with anyone except myself, even then. Now, why would a rational country like Germany switch off its nuclear industry? I mean, it's a powerhouse. Why would that?
I don't know. But people who are closer to the action than I tell me that it was Angela Merkel's and her party's political weakness in the light of a strong Green vote in Germany. Germany actually is the home of the Green movement, the home of the anti-nuclear movement, and Merkel has made a couple of different decisions over the last 2 or 3 years. The first one was to wind down nuclear power, the second one was to wind it up, and the third one was to wind it down again. What is now worrying the Green movement in Germany are the nuclear power plants being built on Germany's borders in Poland. There's a thesis that the closure of the nuclear industry in Germany will in fact prompt the growth of the nuclear industry in the rest of Europe. So,
yeah. Thank you. Gentleman Butai.
I'm Ian Lincoln from the Sydney branch of the Institute, New South Wales branch of the Institute. In the light of your very comprehensive presentation and also of some of the talks I've heard at the Lowy Institute, would it be right to conclude that the focus for your industry is more on export of uranium than on the domestic generation of power, and perhaps also that that's in Australia's interest more broadly, that's to say a focus on exporting less on nuclear power domestically?
Look, it's certainly true that the focus of our association is on production and exports of uranium. There are no members of our association who are seeking to construct or operate nuclear power plants in Australia, although we do have as members REVA. Via its ownership of one Australian company, the China Guangdong Nuclear Power Company. I don't think there's any lobby, there's no business lobby in Australia for nuclear energy. Although CEOs of energy companies in private will have a much more supportive view of nuclear energy than they're prepared to have in public. We were set up to be the advocacy group for uranium miners. We don't produce nuclear power in Australia, so yes, our focus is on exports. Is that more in Australia's interest than going to nuclear power? Well, I think it's certainly in Australia's interest to continue exporting its uranium to a very vigorous market for it. The industry is modest in its in the export dollars it earns the country, but if you think $1 billion a year is modest, some people do. But the energy value of that export is very big. It's almost as big as coal. 7,500 or 10,000 tons of uranium is not much less than the energy value of all of Australia's billions of tons of coal exports. And I guess also from a climate change point of view, 10,000 tons a year of Australia's uranium running producing electricity instead of coal means that 400 million tons of greenhouse gases are avoided.
Zara.
Zara Kimpton from the AAA. I'd like to just maybe to address the issue of disposal of the waste, because that's one of the things that, I'm wondering whether, in fact, that's a potential industry for us, that with our wide open spaces that we can do this. There is a feeling that if we're selling uranium, that we do have some residual responsibility for this, the disposal of the waste. So if you could talk about that issue. And also just the NIMBY factor as far as where any reactors would be able to be located in Australia. Is it possible with technology to locate them a long way away from the populated areas and bring the power by power lines? I mean, they're two sort of they're different questions, but they're maybe related.
You might have to remind me of your later questions when I've answered your former questions. The disposal of nuclear waste, I think, is the most contentious issue there is in this debate. And I'm not surprised to hear the question, and I'm not surprised that my dinner party conversations usually begin with the question of waste. And I'm not surprised that people feel concerned about that. What troubles me is that governments, I think, around the world for 30 years have handled this question very badly. They've had and I think Yucca Mountain in the US, which is where the US was intending to store its nuclear waste, is a classic case. 30 years ago, the government decided it was going to store nuclear waste at Yucca Mountain, and for 30 years has been trying to persuade the public and the legislators and the politicians in Nevada and states adjacent to Nevada that's what they should do, and they failed. And President Obama, I may be talking sacrilege here in the corridors of the nuclear industry, but I think that was probably the right decision by Obama to start again. And he has started again by commissioning what he called a Blue Ribbon Commission to chart a pathway to the establishment of nuclear waste facilities in the United States. And the emphasis in the report of the Blue Ribbon Commission is on community self-selecting, and with a high level of consultation and engagement. And the model, I think, in fact, is to be found in Sweden, where the Swedish government where there's been an organisation which has been doing that work for a very long time, where the model was to ask communities to volunteer to be a host community for nuclear waste, and to have an intensive engagement reflecting and allow the decisions of the community to be reflected in decisions of the government. In fact, what that's done has meant that Sweden will probably finish constructing its nuclear waste facility during this decade. So I think, in the meantime, I should say two other things. One is that nuclear waste can be stored quite successfully, either in wet storage or dry storage on site at nuclear power plants around the world, which is what it does at the moment. Although everybody agrees that the best long-term decision and the safest and secure means of storing nuclear waste is to store it deep underground in stable geological conditions. Nobody disputes that. You choose your site carefully, I think, is the answer to that. But there isn't much dispute about how to do it, how to store the waste, technically speaking. There is dispute about how you choose a site. And I think there are better ways of choosing a site, and there are worse ways of choosing a site. The worst way is to tell a community that your site's going to be here. You've got to have it. A better way is to allow them to select, go through the process, learn more, and in the end decide. In the end, in Sweden, there were two communities competing, and one of them succeeded. In regard to Australia's responsibility, to be honest, I don't share that view. I don't share the view that Australia has a responsibility to store the waste from uranium, its uranium used to produce nuclear power. And I don't think this is not a moral question. I don't believe this is a moral question. And the countries which use nuclear power don't see it as a moral question. They just see it as an operational business question. They take accountability for storing their waste. Just in the same way that they take accountability for storing the waste that they accumulate from using Australia's coal to run their nuclear power plants.
We do have for our own what we would use here. and that's where there's not in my own backyard, and as well as for the actual power.
Australia takes responsibility for its own waste. We've got some mostly low-level waste, which is mainly medical waste stored in hospital car parks. Some of them not far from here. We have some intermediate-level waste, which will be the fuel for the air reactor at Lucas Heights, which is being processed in Europe right now, which will be returned to Australia in the near future and to be stored at the nuclear waste facility. The government, and this is timely, the government is... I don't know whether the debate took place in Parliament today, but I think the debate on the final legislation is imminent. There are still some legal challenges between various groups of traditional owners, each of whom claim to be the right traditional owners, but that's par for the course in this field. So we are well on the way. I think I don't exclude Australia from the criticism I make about governments dealing with finding a site for nuclear waste, although it's been a bit better, I think, in the last few years than in most of the previous 20.
Well, I think you probably padded to the prejudices that a number of people have about Swedes. I mean, I cannot imagine two Australian communities vying with each other, please build a nuclear waste facility next to me. Yeah, that's strange. Okay, more questions? Tim.
Tim Healy, council member. The Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, I understand Iran is a signatory to it. I presume we would not export uranium to Iran. We are prepared to export uranium to India. Can you make some comment about the purpose or utility of the NPT?
Look, I think the Iran example tells you that if countries want to produce nuclear weapons, they will, whatever treaty they've signed. But I think the NPT has been a remarkably successful instrument. Non-proliferation instrument over many years. It's been the basis upon which examples like Iran or North Korea or Libya or Iraq or South Africa and other countries which have been potential producers of nuclear weapons, that's been, I think the NPT has been the rock on which their ambitions founded and has been the means by which the governments of the world have been able to bring pressure on those countries which were tempted or did in fact try to acquire nuclear weapons. It's not wholly successful, but in an imperfect world, it looks to me like the best tool, the optimum tool that we can have in this area. I guess the thing is that once all those scientists in the first half of the last century unlocked the secrets of the atom, it was pretty hard to put them back in the box. So the release of nuclear energy can be used for a variety of purposes, and is well known. I think we're stuck with it. I think the world has to continue to rely upon an instrument like the Non-Proliferation Treaty in order to manage those instances where countries want to act either directly in breach of it or in breach of the spirit of it.
Yes, up the back there.
My name's Alan Patience from the Asia Institute at the University of Melbourne. Can I just note, first of all, that I strongly support uranium exports. I strongly support the idea of a nuclear power industry for Australia. Having said that, I was working in Japan last year and watched, and in fact lost six of my students in a tsunami that came through after the terrible earthquake. I've been reading carefully the report, the recent report coming out of Japan on the Fukushima crisis. And one thing stands out surely, very clearly, that is that the management of the Fukushima power plant is culpable, criminally culpable, for neglecting the safety requirements that they've been warned about time and time again. The government is also culpable because it allowed itself to be bribed and bought off by the owners, TEPCO, of Fukushima Plant. This raises the question for me of how trustworthy, and by the way, your answer to the question about whether or not we should be concerned about our export of uranium to countries that are mismanaging their waste disposal problems, that we have no moral obligation to be concerned about that, you've just made a moral point. And I think the moral point you made is immoral, but that's another time. But surely we need to seriously ask whether the private sector can be trusted. And the Fukushima example shows clearly that it can't.
I didn't know. I think I have to defend capitalism, but look, I think the Fukushima experience is a very salutary one, and whilst I'm a bit reluctant to share the language that you've used, I think there are some very significant lessons coming out of that, which the International Atomic Energy Agency, the government of Japan, governments of other countries are learning and paying close attention to. I went as a member of the Australian delegation. I went to the nuclear safety conference in Vienna in June last year, which was conducted in the wake of Fukushima. What I saw there was a determination to address any regulatory failings, including in those in Japan. I think certainly my own personal view and that of the members of the association would be to learn and apply those lessons in the regulatory frameworks of those countries which use nuclear energy. And if indeed you're right, and that TEPCO and the Japanese government are not to be trusted, then first of all, I think that won't escape the world's attention either. I'd expect some action to be taken via the International Atomic Energy Agency in order to address that issue. But I'm not sure the general view is as pronounced as yours on those issues, but certainly most people are in the same ballpark about wanting to learn and apply the lessons of Fukushima. I might say, whilst nobody died as a direct result of the emergency of Fukushima, and while nobody is likely to die, that's not to underestimate the impact of the emergency of Fukushima. The disruption to people's lives and the uncertainty and concern about radiation, which has been a result of Fukushima, are very, very big issues. And one of the lessons of the Chernobyl disaster was that if people are treated as victims and feel like victims, then their health outcomes will be much worse than if they're treated differently from that. And I think there's some evidence that a better approach to the people who are directly affected by the Fukushima emergency is being taken in Japan. One of the things that needs to be done and still needs to be done is to be very careful about how one talks about radiation. To be honest, I don't know how to crack that, because radiation science is a very challenging and difficult issue for lay people, of which I'm one. I think that's going to remain an issue for some time. Does that address your question? It may not satisfy you, but does it address your question?
It addresses the question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Manus Scott. Just a point about the... you suggest that the uranium industry has huge growth going forward in the future. I've been told stuff by Gavin Mudd, who's a professor in environmental engineering. You know him. And he makes lots of points about the uranium mining industry, but he also made a really good point about the actual global industry as a whole going forward in the future. And his argument is that the actual number of new power plants, nuclear power plants in the world is not increasing. What's happening is because they cost so much to put in the first place, companies are basically just remanufacturing and refitting, refurbishing the reactors, and all which basically gives a higher kilowatt output. It doesn't actually increase the safety of the plant because the economics of building a nuclear power plant, running up 10 years, then dismantling again, is so huge compared to an investment in, say, solar. So when you said before, why is Germany not investing in...
Question?
Oh, my question to you is that do you... You also showed a graph before showing... it was high, but it showed that the uranium supply would plateau going in the future. Would you care to address my comments?
There are four or five regions in the world where you can kind of detect a different approach to develop the nuclear industry. In the US, what's being done there is to expand the capacity and lengthen the life of nuclear power reactors, and that's the stage that they're at prior to building new ones. Right? So you won't see much nuclear construction in the US. You'll see life extensions there. In Europe, they're a step behind. They're a step back from that. They're just in the process of deciding whether they will, in Europe, whether they will expand the capacity and lengthen the life of their reactors. In Russia, there will be a moderate growth in nuclear reactors. Shorten the story, in Asia, in China and India in particular, there'll be rapid growth. So the picture for nuclear power development is not uniform. It differs from place to place. Second question?
Second point. I don't make a point. I guess I'm just trying to say that I think the graph that you showed was a bit misleading, though. Because you showed like over time going to 2030, 2050, global kilowatt output going up in nuclear power.
Yes.
My argument is that I think that trend will not continue in the future. I think if you look at countries like Germany...
You're up against the International Atomic Energy Agency, the International Energy Agency, the World Nuclear Association, the OECD. look, it's, you know, I know people have that view, but there are others who don't.
Stop. There is one last question, and it goes to the gentleman up the back.
As a nuclear expert, I was wondering, what is your expectation about renewable energy sources? Like, they are going to overcome, they are going really to get the job done, offering us like clean energy, or do you think that nuclear energy is our inevitable future?
No. I don't. I think the demand for electricity, as I said in my presentation, is going to grow by 80% between now and 2035. And whilst there will be competition within and between sectors, all the technologies supplying electricity will produce absolutely larger amounts of electricity. And I think that while the world needs nuclear power, it also needs solar power, it needs wind power, it needs geothermal and the like. The difference here is that with nuclear there is a proven and mature technology. Wind is a proven and mature technology. Solar's not, geothermal's not, tidal's not, wave's not. So there's a significant development pathway there, I think coal with carbon capture and storage and gas, all of those have a role, and I certainly wouldn't be imperialistic about it and claim that the answer is nuclear energy, because I don't think it is.
Well, Michael, thank you very much indeed. I think that was quite an elegant and adroit presentation of the issues, and I think you've answered a lot of questions people had. You've posed issues for people to go and think about, and I think one of the realities is the way in which the politics in Australia has accepted by and large, the facts, let's set the Greens aside out of this equation, but the fact of Australian uranium sales to India, I think that was something that was unthinkable 10 years ago. Some will say it's not the right decision, but it's a decision that now is has been mainstreamed in Australian politics. I think we've all found it very interesting, and I'd like to thank you very much on our behalf.